The heavens praise your wonders, Lord, your faithfulness too, in the assembly of the holy ones. For who in the skies above can compare with the Lord? Who is like the Lord among the heavenly beings? In the council of the holy ones, God is greatly feared. He is more awesome than all who surround him. Who is like you, Lord God Almighty? You, Lord, are mighty, and your faithfulness surrounds you.
Righteousness and justice are the foundation of your throne. Love and faithfulness go before you. Blessed are those who have learned to acclaim you, who walk in the light of your presence, Lord. They rejoice in your name all day long. They celebrate your righteousness, for you are their glory and strength. And by your favor, you exalt our horn indeed. Our shield belongs to the Lord, our King, the Holy One of Israel. I have found David my servant. With the sacred oil I have anointed him. My hand will sustain him. Surely my arm will strengthen him. My faithful love will be with him. I will maintain my love to him forever, and my covenant will be with him forever.
If his sons forsake my law and do not follow my statutes, if they violate my decrees and fail to keep my commands, I will punish their sin with the rod, their iniquity with flogging, but I will not take my love from him, nor will I ever betray my faithfulness.
I don't know if you caught what was going on in that psalm, but there's a few elements there that I want to point out too. It starts it off in the psalm, and we'll talk about this briefly here this morning, but the psalm talks about this amazing love, and that we could sing for this about this love forever. I mean, there's something significant about it. But just with what Ted, is that me crackling? Just with what Ted was, just pretend it's not happening. Okay, if you just ignore it, it'll be okay. What Ted was concluding with was there's this point in that psalm that even if all of David's descendants, even if they were all to kind of in a sense turn their back on me, yet, he says, yet will I continue to love them. And we're going to see something amazing with that here this morning. And so if you remember, man, this is not okay, huh? Does this help? Should I go handheld? I'm going to go handheld. It's going to throw everything weird, but we're going to try it. Like I should sing. No, you applaud now until you hear it. So what we're going to see this morning is this amazing love of God. So we've been working through, and I'm getting a little bit out of order here, but that's okay. We've been working through the Advent. And Advent, the word Advent really means anticipation. And so we've been building this anticipation towards Christmas, and we started off a few weeks ago in dealing with, Terry led us through Psalm 80, which was the idea of anticipating this hope, that there's this hope out there somewhere coming. And at that time that psalm was written, was at a time when the Israel had been separated from their homeland. They had been displaced. They had been put in exile. And so there was this hope that they would be returned, that God would come back and love them again, if you will. And so they held on to this hope, and you could see that in the promises. We'll look at that a little bit later too. And then we looked at this idea of anticipating peace, and that followed up by anticipating this joy. And today we're dealing with this anticipating this love. And if you remember, back when we were dealing a few weeks ago with peculiar people, Hosea was one of the people we talked about. In that series of peculiar people, we talked about David, this king that was referred to in the psalm that we read this morning. And David had this peculiar perspective. He's the one that went up against Goliath. You know, perhaps one of the shorter in stature. There wasn't a whole lot to make him appear kingly. And yet he went and did what anyone else and everyone else in Israel was all afraid of doing, including King Saul, who was probably the largest Israelite in the land at that time. David went and did something that all of them else said, no, I'm not going to touch it, and that was to go and face this Goliath of a man. And that's a peculiar perspective where he was able to say, you know, this isn't about me, this is about what God is going to do, and watch God do it. So he had this ability to have this perspective. And then after that, we dealt with this peculiar perspective of Hannah, and how Hannah had not had a child, and she wanted to have a child, and she prayed to God, and then she did this peculiar thing, and she said, God, if you'll give me a child, I will give it back to you. You know, and in our culture, she's like, really? That doesn't quite match up. And so it's just a peculiar nature of Hannah. And then after that, Chris talked about the peculiar faith of Rahab, how this woman who was a non-Jew, a non-Israelite, put her faith in a God, the Jewish God, the Jehovah, God of God, Lord of Lords, King of Kings, put her faith in him, despite the fact that she didn't grow up with it, because she could see that there was a peculiar nature of those Israelite people, that there was something powerful there. And then we concluded it with Hosea. And Hosea had showed this peculiar love. If you're not familiar with the story of Hosea, bottom line is, God said to Hosea, who was a prophet, it says, go and marry a woman who will be unfaithful to you. You know, how would you like that if you were going to go and marry someone and you knew right off the get-go that they were not going to be faithful to you? And God says to him, go and do it. And then what we saw in that life of Hosea, we see Hosea has some kids. And then God calls him and says, I want you to give some names to the kids. The first one I want you to name is that God scatters, because I'm going to take these people of Israel, I'm going to scatter them. The next one I want you to name, you have this daughter, I want you to name your daughter Unloved, because I'm going to pull my love away from the Israelites, and they're going to see what it's like to go from this loving God to just like, wow, God seems to be silent. And that's going to be tough for them. They're going to wrestle with that. And then he goes on and he says, I want you to name your last son, not my people. In other words, I want you to name the last one. You don't belong to me. And then what we have here is we have this passage that God promises, you know, that was for a season, and now watch what I'm going to do. And this is what he says. He says, I will show my love to the one I called, not my love. In other words, that time for you to be out on your own is going to come to an end, and you're going to find that I will draw you back. And just as he called Hosea to go back and buy, I appreciate what Lane said this morning, that you redeemed us at a price. He bought us back, and that's exactly what God calls Hosea to do. Go and buy back your wife. She was unfaithful to you. She belongs to someone else now. And you go, and guess what? It's going to cost you, and you're going to buy her back. And so this is that kind of love. And he says, I will show my love to the one I called not my love. I will say to those who called not my people that you are my people, that you belong to me, and they will say you are my God. And so we look at this idea of anticipating Christmas, and we look at this idea of anticipating hope and peace and love and joy throughout this Christmas season. And so what I want to do is, as we talked about how these psalms that we've been going through kind of point towards these things. And now this morning in the psalm that we heard read by Ted, Liz, and Allie this morning is this picture again of this love. And this love is it's growing. And there's something for us to anticipate. And so what we find here is when we look at this story of Israel, all right, and we've talked about this over the last few weeks, and I realize that not everyone has been here for every week. So we talked about it. And so what ended up happening is that first promise, what we have in Exodus 15:13, it gives us an example. So what happened was we have these people, these Israelites, and God says to them, I am going to give you a gift, okay? I'm going to give you a gift, and it's basically this promised land. I'm going to make this promise to you that I'm going to take you into this land. And this is what we have. Moses wrote it, and he says, in your unfailing love, this is referring to God, in your unfailing love, this love that you have that continues on for us, that never seems to fail, you will lead the people that you have redeemed, these people that you have purchased, these people that you bought out of Egypt, you will lead them in your strength, and you will guide them to your holy dwelling. In other words, you have laid out this gift for them, and now your process is you're taking them, and you're going to take them to that gift, which was the promised land in Exodus 15. That's how it kind of got started. All right, there's this gift that was offered. And then what we see, it didn't end there, because the Israelites were unfaithful. And God said to them, because you've been unfaithful, I got to remove you. There's got to be this consequence. I'm removing you from that land that I had given to you. And then what we have is this promise. We just looked at this in Hosea, where I, God, will restore you. And this is what it said. I will show my love to the one I called not my loved ones, and I will say to those who called not my people that you are now again my people. And so what you see is you see this idea of this gift. He gave the promised land. The people turned their back on God. They left, but God brings them back. He does something better this time. It's the same land, but it's better because now all of a sudden they're seeing the sign of grace. They're now receiving something that they have no basis to think that they've earned, because they have been out on their own. They were shunned from their own land. They were living in exile. And now all of a sudden God's giving them something else, but it's a better package, because now all of a sudden it's not only that love that he had that was taking them to that promised land, but it's filtered with grace because now we didn't deserve to go back. He gave us something better. But then this anticipation continues, and so despite the fact that they've been brought back into the promised land, they're still under, they're not a sovereign nation any longer. They're still under control of whether it's the Babylonians or the Persians or will be the Romans when Christ comes. And so what we see in Isaiah 16, 5, and all throughout the Old Testament, that there's these little snippets, these little promises, and we saw one briefly in Psalm 89 this morning as well, but there's these little snippets that tell you, I got another gift coming. And this is what it says, in love, a throne will be established. In faithfulness, a man will sit on it, one from the house of David. And so this is that promise that there's going to be another gift coming that God is presenting to the Israelites. There's another gift coming. It's coming in the form of a man. It's coming from the line of David. And one, he is the one who, in judging, seeks justice and speeds the cause of righteousness. And so what you have is this additional gift that's coming, and it's promised to even be bigger yet. So not only have they experienced the grace right from the get-go when they got brought back into the promised land, now there's something else that's being promised. They're being promised this nation that will never cease. There's something better. Not only did God bring you back into the promised land, but he's got something better waiting for you. And these people heard it, and these people knew it, and so they're anticipating and they're waiting for this Messiah that's going to bring about this love. But it doesn't end there yet either, because as we look, it'd be way easier if I had your piece. But as we look, in John 15, it says, as the Father has loved me, so I have loved you. Now remain in my love. So in other words, this Messiah, that promised gift came in the form of the Messiah, and God did something even better, but yet it doesn't end there, because now he says, as the Father has loved me, so I have loved you, now remain in my love. And then John 14, 3 says this, if I go, this is Jesus' words, if I go and prepare a place for you, I will come back and take you to be with me, so that where I am, you may also be. In other words, there is a final gift coming that he has laid out for us, that he has promised us in this anticipation. So not only were the people anticipating this promised land that he had provided, then they were anticipating this return to that promised land that came with the grace that they got something that they didn't deserve. And then there was this promise for a Messiah, this established king that would come, and he did that, that would end up being the savior of the world. And now there's still something greater being promised, and this is what's being promised to us, that we will also anticipate in this idea of hope and peace and joy and love, and that is he's going to be coming back. And he has prepared for us a place that we get to go and we get to be with him. And so this is what Christmas and what we're dealing with as anticipation is all about. Yes, it's about Christ coming, but it's more than just a baby story. This is a story of how this gift that not only just keeps on giving, this gift is better and better and better. And it was God's intention from the beginning. It wasn't reactionary. Okay, you weren't happy with the first one, I'll give you something better. That wasn't the case. This large gift was always his intention right from the beginning. And so I want us to look at this idea of love here a little bit this morning. So we get started here. Very familiar passage for a lot of us, John 3:16. And we look at it, and we have it memorized, and you'll go to ball games, and you'll see it. Someone's there holding a sign that says John 3:16. So we've all heard the phrase. We probably all have it memorized at some point in our lives, or at least have been exposed to it. But this is what it says. So it says, for God so loved the world, and that's such a huge, important piece right there, because he loved it enough to do something significant in regards to it. So it said, for God so loved the world that he gave his one and only son, that whoever believes in him shall not perish but have eternal life. And so right there you see that there's this gift being offered. You know, we use this verse all the time for the idea of evangelism, and that's right. But there's a big picture of love that's going on with this passage. It says, for God so loved, God loved the world, God loved the people of the world so much that he was willing to do something about it. He was willing to, in a sense, sacrifice himself. He was willing to offer grace. And this is what I love, and this goes back to that Psalm 89 that Ted, Liz, and Allie read for us. These are the first two verses. Look at this. And this is what it says. It says, I will sing of the Lord's great love forever. With my mouth, I will make your faithfulness known through all the generations. Starts it off, I will sing of the Lord's great love forever. Whoever wrote this psalm, the psalmist was encountered with God's love. Somehow he encountered God's love, and he was affected by it deeply. I've asked Daniel for his help. Daniel's going to come up here. Daniel, I needed to have someone who's very safe-minded, someone who's been around fire a lot and knows how to be safe around fire. He wasn't available. So I got Daniel here and said, Daniel, there's a torch down there, and it would behoove us to not have this handy. Okay? So I'm going to have you safely.
Where?
I don't know, but away from me. Okay. No, you can't go that far. So I need you to light the torch. I want to give a little illustration here with this idea. Don't break it. Okay. Lefty loosey, righty tighty. Okay, there you go. Oh, yep. Keep going. Do I need to open that for you? I hear gas.
Scared.
A little nervous. Okay. Here's this idea. Okay, so you have the psalmist, and the psalmist at some point encountered God's love. All right? And just merely by being encountered by God's love, it affected this psalmist so much that he says, I have experienced this love, and now I will sing of this great love forever. Okay? So just as we come by and we just, experience God's love, maybe you can't see it well, but just by a little blow-by, I've been affected. I've been changed. And sure, I could take some sandpaper and I could probably sand it down, but is it exactly the same? It's not. Just by simply being near God's love, I'm going to be affected. And then the longer I stay in God's love, the more affected I'll be. And if you can't see it there, the idea of whoever cleans the carpet is going to hate me. Okay? Yeah, same idea. The more I go by God's love, the more affected I am by it, and I will never be the same. I'm sorry about the carpet. But do you see the picture? You can turn it off safely. Righty, tighty, yep. Now that end is hot. Set it safely. Thank you, Daniel. But do you see the point? Okay, some examples through the scriptures. Think of Zacchaeus. Zacchaeus was this wee little man. Okay? And a wee little man was he. All right? Short guy, short fella. We find it in Luke chapter 19. I'll read it for you here in a little bit. But so Zacchaeus was this short man, and he had heard that Jesus was coming into town, and so Zacchaeus wanted to see Jesus. All right? And so in chapter 19 of the Gospel of Luke, Zacchaeus decides to climb a tree because he's heard that Jesus is coming. And so he climbs this tree to look at Jesus. He wants to get a sight of him. So, and as Jesus is coming by, we learn a few things in chapter 19. It says that Zacchaeus was a chief tax collector. And in this culture, just so you understand the reality of what was going on, a tax collector in this culture was probably a Jewish man asked or commissioned or paid by the Romans to collect taxes from his own people. Because the Romans are going to be taxing the people. And so he's commissioned to go do something that his oppressors, in a sense, won't do. He's asked to go and collect taxes from your own people, which is like, wow, that's harsh, Zacchaeus. I mean, that's rough. Why would you go and do that? That's just, insult to injury. How can you collect tax? And what was worse, he was a chief tax collector. So in other words, he was one of these higher-ups, and so he had people working underneath him. And not only that, when he would go and collect taxes, he was going out and saying, hey, you owe this amount of money, and really they owed much less than that. And so basically what he's doing is he's collecting not only what needs to be paid to Rome, but he's collecting a little bit for himself too, and putting it in his pocket. And everyone knew it, but they couldn't do anything about it because he was under Roman protection. Because Romans had commissioned him to collect the taxes. So he's hated. Here comes Zacchaeus. Well, guess what? He's just going to try to steal our money. We can't do anything about it. We can't stop him. He's going to come and take our money, keep some of it for himself, give some to the Roman government. But we're stuck having to deal with guys like this, and we can't stand him. So here is this tax collector who wants just to get a glimpse at Zacchaeus. He goes up into a tree. Jesus comes by, and Jesus says to Zacchaeus, Zacchaeus, why don't you come down? I'm going to go and eat at your place today, which got everyone kind of all upset, saying, why would he do that? He's going to eat with a sinner. Jesus is going to go eat with a sinner, because that's exactly what Zacchaeus was. He was a cheat and a steal and a liar. Everyone knew it. Even Zacchaeus knew it. But he was getting rich and wealthy in doing it, so he had no interest in stopping. And so Jesus comes by and says, I'm going to eat at your house today, which was a cultural taboo. But it happens, and I want you to see what Zacchaeus' reaction is in his encounter with Christ's love. Look at this. It says, but Zacchaeus stood up. After encountering this love of Jesus Christ, Zacchaeus stood up and said to the Lord, look, Lord, here and now I give half of my possessions to the poor, and if I have cheated anybody out of anything, I will pay back four times the amount. We don't see any evidence that Jesus condemned Zacchaeus with his words. We don't see any evidence that Jesus kind of said, Zacchaeus, you're a sinner, you're awful, and what you've done is wrong, and now you need to give back. We don't see evidence. That doesn't mean that some of that didn't happen. We don't know that, but we don't see evidence of it. It's not specified. What is specified is that Zacchaeus has this encounter with Jesus Christ and has experienced nothing but Jesus' acceptance of him and who he is, not for what he's doing, but who he is as a man, as a human being, and he loves him in such a way that he's willing to do something that all of Israel won't do, because all of Israel's got Zacchaeus out here. No way, Zacchaeus. You're not welcome into our house. You're going to charge me a tax. I'll invite you to dinner. You'll charge me a tax for the dinner. And then I'll have to pay on top of that some other user fee just to use the plates that we're using. And all of it's just to pad your pocket. And what we have is Jesus saying, no, in fact, you're welcome here. In fact, I'm going to come to your house. We're going to eat together. You're going to experience my love. And when you experience my love, you'll be changed. When you experience my love, you can't help but be different. We saw it with Moses. Moses was up on Mount Sinai. And God reveals to him in his glory. And when Moses came down from the mountain, it said his face shone like the sun. Okay, literally, it's not just he had a big broad smile on his face. It said literally that he had to wear a veil over his face because he was shining bright and people couldn't look at him without having to divert their eyes. Likewise, we see this woman at the well, this Samaritan woman. We talked about it a number of months ago. We have this woman who's sitting at the well, and Jesus comes by and says, give me a drink of water. And she says, who do you think you are to ask me for a drink of water? Man, woman, that's a big issue. Jew, Samaritan, another big issue. And Jesus sets all that stuff aside and says, my love is going to transform you. Watch it happen. And you saw it happen. And she goes down in the town and she says, you will not believe who I just saw. It has in a sense transformed my life. I am totally different now because I've just encountered the love of the Savior. We also saw it with that woman that was condemned by all of her accusers. Remember? They're ready to stone her. There she is at Jesus' feet. They haul her in. They drop her at Jesus' feet and say, the Bible says, the scriptures say that we're supposed to stone such women. What do you say? And Jesus says, if you don't have any sin, by all means, throw the first stone. Well, they all know that they're all guilty. But then this amazing thing happens at the end. Jesus says, where have all of your accusers gone? And she says, they've all left. And Jesus says, then neither do I condemn you. There's consequences for sin. I don't want to miss that. There is consequences for sin. If you sin, there's going to be some consequences. And the Lord has his authority and his prerogative to establish those consequences to any of us. However, I don't want us to miss this reality that when we are exposed to the love of God, you can't help but be transformed. And if you're finding that your life is not being transformed, I have to think that perhaps you're throwing up some form of a shield. Daniel had the torch here. We got to see the stuff kind of just, it's affected by it, just by the mere presence, just by walking by, it's affected. But sometimes we throw up this shield. It's like, no, Lord, I don't want you to transform me right now because I know that that's going to affect me and I don't really want to change right now. So we throw up this shield sometimes, thinking that I'm good where I'm at and I don't want to be transformed. But I'm telling you, to allow the Lord to use his love to transform us, oh, you will experience his love in such a deep and powerful way. And we're going to see something here briefly this morning that's going to absolutely, I think, it blew my socks off. I think all of us will be barefoot in no time. Because his love is not just this love that's passive. We talk about, oh, Jesus loves you. It is so much deeper. It is so much richer. It is so much more powerful than that. And it's not just love. It's this extravagant love. It is a love beyond love. It is an amazing love. And I want us to see in the Gospel of John, First John, I shouldn't say, not the gospel. The epistle of 1 John chapter 3. We're going to get this language and this picture. And what we find is that John, when he writes the epistle, he's much older in life. He's the same author that wrote the Gospel of John. He's also the same author that wrote Revelation. And in this epistle, he's writing to churches. And he's writing specifically to these churches who are, they're believers in Jesus, but they've been kind of infiltrated by some false teaching. And specifically, they're infiltrated by what's called Gnosticism. And Gnosticism had kind of two primary beliefs. One was that you only could be saved if you received some form of special knowledge from the Lord. It was very knowledge-based and not any kind of experiential or physical-based, because they believed that the body was all evil and anything that you experienced was evil. And so what they kind of did with that, they used it to kind of justify their sin, saying, you know, the body's all evil anyway, all matter is evil, and so it really doesn't matter what you do with your body. You can go and you can sin, you can go have promiscuous relationships, whatever you want to do, it really makes no difference, because that's not what's going to save you anyway. It's only the special knowledge. So forget that stuff and just seek this greater special knowledge. And John is saying, no, you guys are missing it. What's amazing with it is John points out, and John, we see it all through his gospel, we're going to see it in the epistle here, it's all about love. Look at this. And John, 1 John chapter 3, this is what it says. See what great love the Father has lavished on us. This word lavished, if you look at the Greek and the words that they use to translate into lavish, also translate into words like abundance, also translate into words like leftovers, into words like overflow. And so what, in a sense, what we're seeing here is, see what great love the Father has lavished on us that we should be called his children. Do you have any idea? You don't belong to be his children. And he said, you are my children, and I have lavished this love on you. I want you to see this. Maybe this will give you a picture. I realize you may have a little bit of trouble seeing. I'm going to try to do this one-handed. Okay? I want you to give you a picture. So here's this idea. Excuse me. I'm sorry. Sometimes I say things I shouldn't be. Okay. So here's God's love. Okay. And what ends up happening is we have these containers that we go around thinking, oh, yeah, I need some more of God's love. And so what we do is we say, yes, Jesus, I want some of your love. Oh, better slow down. That's about all I can take. Okay? Oof. I can't handle too much of it. You know, my container's only so big. And if you go too much, then I don't know what I would do with all that love. And so we get there. I was okay. We let it settle down a little bit. We get to enjoy his love. Maybe we'll sip on it, you know, here and there. But that's not his intention at all. Because when you look at this word lavished, literally what that word means is God is giving us his love. Oh, wait, that's more than I need. Wait, you better slow down, you know. And he just doesn't. He just keeps lavishing. And there it goes. And it's intended to overflow. It's intended to keep going. And just when you think you can't take any more, you can't take any more, and it just keeps going. That's what he's saying here. He says, this love I have given to you, I have lavished on you. It doesn't matter who you are or where you've been. I have lavished this love on you. Even if you think that you keep messing up over and over again, that God can't love me anymore, sorry, you're wrong, because we just saw that with what Ted specifically read this morning when he said, even when you mess up, even if you turn your back on me, I will still love you. And this is the description of his love. He says, I have lavished it on you, and it's intended to overflow. Sometimes we kind of hit that capacity. It's like, nope, that's all I can take. Because you give me any more, I don't have any place to put it. That's the point. Because what we have is, when God has loved us so much that we can't help it and we're just spilling over, guess what? Then I have God's love that has just affected me, and I'm spilling over, and I come walking by someone else, and I've got that love that is just spilling over. Guess what? It's designed to affect them as well. And so you see, this is this crazy love that we talk about when we talk about how Jesus loves you. And we look at it and we say, yeah, no big deal. That's a big deal. That's a big deal. I mean, how can God have so much love to continue to do that? And he says that you have no business being my children, yet I call you my children. And that is what you are. The reason the world does not know us is that it did not know him. Here's the idea. The world doesn't know us because it has no idea what to do with that. Because we compartmentalize it. We got to keep things into place. We can't have spilling. Then you got a big old root beer mess. You know? We can't have that. You can't love extravagantly that way. What'll that do to your pocketbook? I don't know. Might make a big root beer mess. And then he says, John says, dear friends, now we are children of God, and what we will be has not yet been made. In other words, I am doing this transforming work in you. I am pouring out my love in you. You can't help but be affected by the love that I'm pouring out on you. And I'm not finished with that transforming work. So if you think you're here, it's like, either I've arrived, you haven't, okay, surprise, wow. Or you've arrived saying, I'll never get there. You're right, you kind of won't, but he's doing that transforming work. He's in that process of working in you and saving you. All right, he's not done with that business yet. But we know that when Christ appears, we shall be like him, for we shall see him as he is. And that's the idea. That when I allow Jesus, when I allow God to fill me up with his love, and I just like keep pouring, okay, I can't take anymore, but go ahead, keep pouring, and we start to overflow with that love, then we become like him in the fact that we can then go and share and love people that same way and have it overflow and overflow and overflow. And all who have this hope in him purify themselves just as he is pure. And I've grasped this. You know, you can't do anything. We've talked about this over and over again. You can't create in yourself your own righteousness. That's self-righteousness. It doesn't work. We see it in scriptures all the time. You can't have it. The only way you can have that purification, the only way you can have that righteousness, and when Jesus says, I am calling you pure, even though you're not, I am calling that on you. I am covering you with my blood. I'm covering you with my righteousness so that, there, you're good. It doesn't change what it is that you've done, but it changes your position with him, but mostly it transforms you from the inside out, and you find that heart, maybe it was a heart of stone at one point, is now softening into that heart of flesh, and now you're able to receive that love, and it's like, you're just bursting, and you're bursting, and you're flowing over. I think as we look at Christmas, what a fabulous opportunity that we have to love people. You know, and we think that maybe we're maxed out on our capacity to love people, and that's kind of the point. Because when you don't have the capacity anymore, God's still loving you, and he's still pouring out from you, and that's where you find that he continues to love people even through you. You have a God who loves you so much, and he will love you beyond your capacity so that you can love others beyond their capacity. You know, and then he circles, and we see it in this verse, he circles back to hope, right where we started from, this anticipating hope, that we have such a hope in him. And it's no wonder that we can have such a hope in Jesus. You know, sure, we're born in a sinful nature and we sin and we deserve nothing that he has to offer. But what God has called clean and purified, we have no business telling him, no, I'm not. Because his love and his righteousness has made clean that which only he can make clean. You know, Romans 8 gives us this beautiful picture of how we cannot be separated from God's love. You can't. You know, just like we saw this kind of flowing over, I can try to pull myself away from that. It doesn't matter. You cannot separate yourself from his love. Even if you throw up that shield and you're saying, I don't want your love, well, you can't separate yourself from the love. You're still loved. The difference is maybe you're not in a point where you're ready to be affected or transformed by it. Does that make sense? That's what that shield kind of prevents you from being able to be transformed by his love. But when we can put down the shield and say, Lord, I don't have anything. I don't know what it is that you want me to do. All I have right now is for me to be able to say, you love me. I don't know why. Transform me. I'm walking by the flame. You get to do the work. Transform me. Because I don't like me. You say you love me. I don't know how that all works. Transform me. Do that.